What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, we are told that those who fail to heed the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them.
I believe that. We got to watch history. We got to know our history so we don't make those mistakes again. That's true.
But it's really interesting how quickly we forget things. Because you think about 10 years ago, just a decade, which is just a split moment in time when you think about it historically, and we had a financial crisis in America that a lot of people are still reeling from. They really are.
Well, and there's some that say that's a 10-year cycle that we're due for another one. And I don't believe we've done anything really to prevent or to help us not have a financial crisis. I think our government, again, has failed us.
Well, maybe we just pumped everything up so much with all that 0% interest rate at the Fed that now we're having to ultimately put it into right balance, because that's something that we rarely have done in our history for the length of time that we did. And we took extreme measures to get out of this financial crisis. Some say that we helped out Wall Street to the detriment of Main Street.
Well, I think we did, and nobody went to jail. I mean, there was a lot of illegal things going, and nobody went to jail. And now we see GM again. They took government money, and now they're closing facilities in the United States and leaving ones open. So you sort of wonder, they have no, they don't care, really.
Well, you think about it. I mean, we have this chant, lock her up, lock her up. And you don't see people out on the streets saying, well, the head of Bear Stearns or the head of Goldman Sachs,
they should have been locked up.
Lock them up. Why do we save our outrage for certain things? And yet the things that have affected us politically, economically, for the last 10 years, I mean, let's be honest about it. Donald Trump never would have been elected president if a lot of people didn't think that they were left behind as a result of what happened 10 years ago.
Well, I think, too, I think we can blame the media. The media is really
supposed
to be...
The media?
That's us.
That's us?
I'm
blaming you, John. I'm not blaming myself.
Okay. Well, because they're supposed to be there as our eyes and ears for these people, and they've really let us down to some extent. I mean, they've blown up things that really aren't anything, and they disregard things that are really important, like people, you know... I mean, I feel taken back because these people didn't go to jail. I mean, they should have. I would have gone to jail if it was me.
Well, you still may.
I mean, you never know.
That's an open case that we still have here in our state about John. But having said that, I mean, the issue is, well, where do we go from here? And did we solve any of the problems? We put a lot of things into effect. You remember TARP. You remember Dodd-Frank. And so the question really is, are we on the precipice of making the same mistake again? Or have we adjusted appropriately? Are there enough safeguards in place? Are we beginning to whittle them back if they were sufficient at one moment in time? What about Glass-Steagall? Do we need that back again? Well, you and I thought it was important enough, John, to do two podcasts about this.
Absolutely.
And so they're both coming in succession. The first one is with Edward Pinto, and he's an expert on these issues with the American Enterprise Institute, and we will give you his bona fides, and they are substantial. And then we have another one that we'll introduce in our next podcast. But why don't we listen to Ed, and we'll talk for an hour about the financial crisis and where we are today, 10 years on, here on America Trends. Joining us once again on America Trends is Edward Pinto. He was the chief credit officer for Fannie Mae back in the 1990s and now co-directs the American Enterprise Institute Center on Housing Markets and Finance. And he's a former FDIC and Federal Reserve economist. You certainly have the bona fides to tell us what happened back in 2008, 2009. Just explain it in the simplest terms that you can, but take us all to school.
Okay, great. Thanks, Larry, for the opportunity to be on the program once again. And let me just correct one thing. I was at Fannie Mae in the 80s. I call that before they went over to the dark side, because the events really started in the early 90s. And a correct diagnosis of what happened in 2008 and the financial crisis that came about as a result of massive house price drops were government housing policies that forced a systematic loosening of underwriting standards, all in the name of promoting affordable housing. And that effort really took root in about 1992 when Congress passed the so-called Safety and Soundness Act for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we know how that turned out. And buried in that Safety and Soundness Act was a requirement that Fannie and Freddie enter the subprime market and loosen their underwriting standards, begin competing with the Federal Housing Administration, which is the federal government's longtime subprime guarantor, and with private subprime lending. And all of that mandated the two largest investors in mortgages in the world to shift their business practice. And that started happening in the early 1990s and continued literally virtually up to the point that they collapsed and were put in conservatorship in 2008. We've been able to document how this credit loosening started, as I said, in the early 1990s, continued for this entire period. House prices started going up rapidly in terms of relative to inflation in about 1998 and didn't stop until early 2007. And by then, house prices were way out of whack with any what we call fundamentals, rents, incomes, inflation, construction costs, any measure you want to consider that should have some relationship to house prices, they were vastly out of whack with those. And the result was it couldn't be sustained, and house prices crashed back almost in many cases the level where they had started, and the home ownership rate literally went back to the level that it had started in 1992.
But take us back to Lehman Brothers and its collapse and the Federal Reserve stepping up, stepping in to bail out the banks such as Citigroup. I mean, put the private sector in the middle of this too.
So the and I think we talked about this on the last program, the biggest bailout was Fannie and Freddie because they had $5 trillion in outstanding obligations, roughly seven times the size of Lehman. Lehman fails the following week, but Fannie and Freddie fail, I think, September 7th or so in 2008. And what happened was that assets that these companies had that they thought were valued at, you know, something close to par or full value turned out not to be worth what they thought as house prices started collapsing and reverting, retracing their dramatic climb that had taken place and start going back down. And their capital levels, and Lehman Brothers had about a 50 or 60 to 1, no, it was less than that, even a 20 to 1 capital ratio, which was relatively healthy, again, compared to Fannie and Freddie, which were capitalized at like 70 times to 1. So for every dollar outstanding, they had a dollar of capital. Well, Lehman Brothers had, for every dollar that they had outstanding, they had, you know, 5% capital, a lot more than Fannie and Freddie. But they were still over-leveraged and collapsed along with then threatened the banks. And the Fed then ended up stepping up and bailing out the banks, the AIG, Lehman Brothers. But it all started with this systematic loosening of underwriting standards. And everybody said, well, if Fannie and Freddie are doing it, it must be okay. We've never had a synchronized house price crash since the 1930s. It won't happen again. And lo and behold, we had what's known as a Minsky moment, which is when things were very calm. Remember what was called the Great Moderation?
Yes.
And everybody was bragging how we had eliminated risk and this was the Great Moderation. Well, that Great Moderation turned out to be an illusion. It was really a debt-fueled increase in prosperity that went on for many years. And then when that came time to pay the debt, everything deflated back to roughly where they started.
Is it fair to say that what we were looking at back then was a combination? You had the lax government oversight, you had deregulation, you had reckless lending, you had Wall Street gluttons, you had blatant fraud. I mean, that really it was a real stew.
You can say that, but I tend to look at it, what's the one fact without which this would not have happened? And that one fact was setting Fannie and Freddie in 1992 at the mandate of Congress on this, what in hindsight turned out to be ridiculous goal of making subprime loans all across the fruited plain. And competing with other subprime guarantors like FHA and subprime lenders, private subprime lenders. That was insanity, but Congress decided they wanted to do it. Ironically, it was done to make housing more affordable, but we now know in hindsight, housing was much more affordable in 1992 before Congress started tinkering with this than it was in 2007 when housing was much more expensive relative to incomes than it had been in 1992. So it happens many times with the government policy, they say X and Y happens. They say, oh, we're going to make housing more affordable, but in reality, what they've done is make it less affordable. That process is going on again today. We have not learned the lesson of what happened last time. And this ties to your question, Larry. This time, there's no question the private sector isn't even involved. The federal government is guaranteeing 90% of all the first-time buyer loans in this country. Mm. They're guaranteeing 85% of all the primary home purchase loans in this country.
And what was it at that time?
It varied over time. By 2007, it might have been the government was guaranteeing maybe 50%, 55%. At one point, it might have been 70%. But today, it's, as I said, it's 85 to 90%. And that's been going on for many years. So the boom that we're seeing today is done through the same means, this leverage, that loosening of credit standards that's going on. But there's no question that the only ones who are loosening are the government.
But why am I reading that some of those quasi-governmental institutions are in good financial shape?
Well, like such as?
Like Freddie Mae.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
Yeah. So basically, they are making money today, which it's dividended back to the taxpayers for guaranteeing all of their debt. But they're making money today because they have no competition. They are basically monopolies, mm-hmm. and they charge monopoly prices, and they're making very good spreads. The second issue is, and this happened the last time also, as long as house prices are going up 5-6% a year, the losses are very low. Most people don't remember that the delinquency rates on loans were the lowest in 15 years, the quarter before house prices started collapsing. Delinquency rates are not a leading indicator. Low delinquency rates don't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm. All they're telling you is rates are low. Why are they so low today? Well, again, if house prices are going up 5-6% a year, then if you go under some financial stress as an individual and you might go delinquent, you can sell your house. You can refinance. It's only when it comes under stress, when you have unemployment going up, and right now we have record low unemployment, when you have unemployment going up, when you have a recession going on, that you understand. I think the best example was Warren Buffett said, it's only when the tide goes out is when you find out who's swimming without a bathing suit.
Don't
find out what you've actually done with these risky loans until the tide goes out.
Okay. How close are we to the tide going out?
Well, that, nobody knows because, and this goes back to an economist that I follow. He wrote many books, including one on urban land economics in 1949, and he said, we know real estate goes in cycles. What we can't tell, we know where we are in a cycle. Are we in the up cycle or in the down cycle? But what we can't tell is the ultimate height that cycle will go up to, or the depth it will go to, and we can't tell the date when that event will occur. No human can figure that out, because the thing that makes the cycle turn could be any one of 8 or 10 external events. Now, those external events eventually always occur. I was just looking at a chart earlier today that goes back to 1951, and it traces house prices and the cycles they go through, and there just is a regular series of these cycles. And all I can tell you is the current cycle we're in is the second longest since 1951. The first longest is, of course, the big one from the mid to late 90s to 2007. It also has had the largest increase in real home prices in absolute terms than all but the largest one. It beats all of the other cycles that have occurred since 1951. There's been about a half a dozen of them. And one or two of them were quite serious before the one in the 2007. And so all we know is this cycle is building up to be a very strong up cycle. And therefore, we would expect, based on history going back, you know, many, many decades, that the reverse, as the cycle ends and goes to the boom goes to a bust, that it's going to be a strong down cycle. How strong, nobody can tell. The other thing we know from history is the longer the cycle goes on, the more painful the reversion to whatever that trend is.
Well, let me go back to 2008 and 2009 and the banks and all of this. Now, maybe the leading edge of this was the government, but the banks are pretty smart and they know where risk lies and they're risk averse, we were told. Now, when we look at these credit default swaps going back several years and a lot of insurance to underpin what might have been known to them as being rather risky in terms of these subprime loans, what role did that play? And explain as clearly as you can a credit default swap.
Okay, one of the big problems was that and the rating agencies were complicit in this. They basically assumed that there wasn't going to be systemic risk across the entire country when you made a lot of bad loans. I mean, remember, these loans were called subprime mortgage-backed securities. It wasn't like somebody hid them in a pristine-sounding name. The name on the security in each case was subprime.
But weren't they put into these tranches? So they were kind of
mixed? Were put into tranches, and they were rated AAA. And so the rating agencies, a big mistake they made, they assumed that if you made a bunch of loans and they were rated as AAA for that tranche of the security, over this tranche, and then you independently had another security over here and you rated that one, there wouldn't be any interaction or systemic risk between the two. And what turns out, and we now know, and we're continuing to research on this, but based on what we know of what's going on today with house prices, what we find is that as the percentage of loans that are high risk in a particular census tract increases above a certain percentage, and we've found that that percentage is about 30%. Once it hits that point, what happens is those buyers, that 30% or 40% or whatever the percent that have these high-risk loans, those buyers get to set the price for everyone. Think of an auction. You go to an auction and there are five bidders. Whoever ends up winning the bid is the marginal buyer setting the price for everybody. And that's what happens in housing. If you're looking at buying a house and there's somebody who just keeps bidding and they win, that person ends up becoming the marginal buyer. What normally happens as house prices go up faster than income is that the marginal buyer, the one who's constrained by income, drops out, which reduces demand relative to supply, which allows prices either not to go up so fast, and eventually, if it happens extensively, then house prices could actually decline. But more likely, you're just going to get a reduction in the increase in house prices, which would be known as disinflation, as opposed to absolute declines, which would be deflation. And so what the government does is say, to people who are low income through these programs like FHA and Fannie and Freddie, say you don't need to make the compromise of dropping out as a bidder. We're going to give you more leverage to use. Now, of course, that leverage comes with a price. It's riskier. But the buyers seem, you know, last time and seem this time to be relatively indifferent to that risk. How else can we explain that FHA, which is a very large guarantor in this country, about 20% of the market is guaranteed by FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, yet 28% of their home buyers that they guarantee have debt-to-income ratios pre-tax that over 50%, meaning every month they're paying more than 50% out in debt relative to their income. And they'll go up to 57%. I mean, you go, wow. And it's wow because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in 2013 said there should be a rule that says you shouldn't go above 43. And what did they do on the same day they issued the rule? They exempted FHA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Veterans Administration. So they exempted the government from the rule. And so what do we have today?
Well, if they're underpinning 85% of the loans, so that means virtually everyone who's getting a mortgage is exempt.
Everyone's getting exempt. So today, more than half of FHA borrowers are above 43%. Almost 30% of Fannie Mae borrowers are above 43%. I mean, these are numbers that you go, wait a minute, what, you know, how does this happen? Well, the government exempted itself.
Okay, I see what's coming down the road here. I do. And it's nerve-wracking because when you look at it, the individuals in our society, they haven't really recovered since 2008. Many. We're reading about income inequality. We're reading about flat wages. We're reading a lot of people falling out of the quote-unquote middle class. I mean, when you look at individuals in our society, some think that our political issues today and even the election of Donald Trump can be traced back to 2008. What do you think?
I think there's something to be said for that. I think, you know, combined with the I have a statement about free trade. It's very simple. It can't possibly be free trade if it takes 1,200 pages to describe it. You know, the First Amendment is, I don't know how many words, but 72 words, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's very short.
Very short. If we had a First Amendment that were 37 pages, I can guarantee you we wouldn't have freedom of the press, freedom of religion, or freedom of speech. And so free trade can't require 1,000 or 2,000 pages. I just don't believe that makes sense. So number one. Number two, and I just sent out a post to people that follow my work, and I basically had a map of Phoenix, Arizona. And you recall Phoenix, along with Riverside, San Bernardino, California, Las Vegas, you know, Florida, those were ground zero in the last event. And Phoenix was certainly, you know, one of the ground zeros. And this shows the combination of risk and house price appreciation that's going on color-coded on this map. And then I have a second map, which showed where the foreclosures were in the last event as of 2010 that the Federal Reserve had put out. And you could just about overlay the map. So today we're making high-risk loans with outsized house price increases in the exact same areas that we had the foreclosures last time. We're doing it again.
So what does this portend? What does this all suggest?
Well, it's not too late to fix this. We have recommended to various, you know, government agencies, FHA, the Financial Consumer Protection Bureau, and the Treasury Department and FHFA that they take certain steps. We don't know whether they're going to take them or not. The next 3 or 4 months are key. And if we don't get some direction that, you know, we need to start pulling back from all of this craziness. You know, for example, again, FHA, 28% of their loans above 50% debt-to-income ratio. And that percentage is going up. It went up last month. It went up the month before. It continues to rise. So that's not a good sign. So if we don't see some evidence that they're actually making some changes, in the next 3 or 4 months, by February or so, then we're kind of on a path that at some point there'll be this event. Again, we don't know what that event can be. It could be an international event. It could be a recession. Eventually, there will be a recession.
Put this all in a stew with all of the debt that the United States continues to accumulate. And I don't know what number you agree to. I know that one of our guests in the past from BU, Lawrence Kotlikoff, thinks we're about $200 trillion in the hole with all the fiscal obligations for everyone born today against tax revenues assumed. I don't know what number you agree to, but how long can that bubble keep building?
Yeah, that's I focused on the 1/6 of the economy that's housing. Now you're talking about a lot of the rest. I can't even fathom that. I mean, those numbers are
they are startling. Okay, then let me ask you to fathom this. The Dodd-Frank legislation, and that has been changed over the recent period. Financial stress tests for banks, too big to fail. The TARP program, the HARP program, all of the things that came in the wake of the financial crisis. What cumulatively has been the effect of all that we did to try to stop the bleeding?
Well, again, let's go be very specific about what the Bureau for Consumer Financial Protection did in 2013 under its Dodd-Frank authority for a qualified mortgage. It exempted the entire federal guarantee system. So here we had Dodd-Frank that said you're supposed to set qualified mortgage standards for the industry. And what did the Bureau that Dodd-Frank set up do? It exempted the 85% of the mortgages that are guaranteed by the government. So okay. I would say in that respect, that is an abject failure of Dodd-Frank. They did the exact opposite. And ironically, when they announced it in January 2013, I wrote an op-ed saying this was going to lead to the next boom. At that time, we didn't know the next boom had already started. It started in mid-2012, but it takes about 9 or 10 months for it to actually show up in the data and start a trend. Well, it turns out, in hindsight, we now know the boom started in July 2012 and has continued unabated to today and continues very strong. But in January 2013, they put this rule in place, exempt the federal establishment from it, and literally set us on a path for the next boom when, in fact, their job is to make sure that doesn't happen. So I would say Dodd-Frank, from that perspective, is a complete failure. It did the exact opposite and gave us the illusion that we had some protection. Remember, I can't remember who said it. It was either Dodd-Frank. You know, we now have the ability to see around corners. I'm sorry, they can't see a freight train coming down a tunnel. This was completely predictable. I say that because I wrote an op-ed in January 2013 that said this is the beginning of the next boom. Given what they've done in exempting all these federal agencies, they basically set us on a path for the next boom because that was the exact kind of loosening that happened last time. We know how it happened. It's happening again.
What about the banks in all of this today? I mean, I know if they're only underwriting 15% of the mortgages, but are they stronger or are they?
They're much stronger. So first of all, they're a much stronger capital position. That's not my specialty, but my feeling is they're in a much stronger capital position than they were. But in particular, and we know this, we risk rate, the entire market. And we estimate that, FHA has a risk rating of 28%, which means that if we had another stress event, 28% of FHA loans would go into foreclosure, which of course would be a catastrophe for both all those individuals, the neighborhoods, and the taxpayers. The banks, when we look at their risk exposure, they're at about 3 or 4%. And we define anything below 6% as a low risk loan. And we define anything above 12 as a high-risk loan. And so the banks are, by and large, making low-risk loans. Ironically, if you went back to the early 1950s, when we had a homeownership rate that wasn't that much lower than where we are today, and in 1962 it was about the same, we virtually all the loans in the marketplace were low-risk. So we've had a policy for the last since the mid-1950s, where our policy has been we're going to take low-income individuals and who have, you know, the, by definition, the least income, the most variability in things going on in their lives. We're going to give them the highest risk loans. We're going to drive up the prices of homes with that, which creates all this volatility, and put them in loans that are very prone to foreclosure under stress. And we call that a homeownership policy. Well, that is, that policy has failed for decades. We need something different, and it can be done, but we don't appear to have the political will to do it.
In the New York Times, David Lenhart wrote, "By the official statistics, 10 years after the fall of Lehman Brothers, the American economy has fully recovered." But he went on to say, look closely, however, and you can see the lingering effects of the financial crisis everywhere. Are we really in a boom phase that is sustainable, or do you think the next financial crisis is just around the horizon?
Again, I can't make a prediction about the next financial crisis. All I can say is, I mean, we are in what appears to be a, from the economy point of view, a continuing strong economy. Now, part of that was due to the Tax Act. The bad part of the Tax Act is to the extent it's funded by deficit spending, which, you know, a chunk of it was, that's the bad part. To the extent it actually increases productivity and growth, that's the good part. We seem to be growing enough faster than we were that it can't all be accounted for by the Tax Act. Therefore, the direct deficit spending part of the Tax Act. Therefore, we actually are getting some very positive results. But that still can't go on forever. Eventually, there will be a recession. There just has to be. I mean, we've not banned business cycles. We thought we had done that before, and we had, you know, turned out to be not true. So, but again, when this will happen, I don't know. I think it will likely happen just because of the length of time. It will likely happen sometime before 2023, 2024, but it could happen in 2020.
But by what you're suggesting, it looks like, in my mind, that housing will again be at the fore edge of this.
It will be, except it probably won't have the impact on the banks, the depository institutions, because they haven't taken on much of the risk. The impact is going to be on the buyers who are in these areas who bought, let's assume it happened in 2021. Anybody who bought after early 2018 in these areas that continue to have these prices going up very rapidly will then find out that they're swimming without the bathing suit when the tide goes out. And so they're going to get hurt. The taxpayers are going to get hurt because FHA, if the economy catches a cold, FHA catches pneumonia. And that pneumonia is in these neighborhoods, these same neighborhoods in Phoenix. That's where FHA does its lending. It's the same places that subprime lending was done last time, but now it's being done by FHA.
All right. Edward Pinto, I can't thank you enough for coming back on America Trends. And, of course, he was the chief credit officer for Fannie Mae in the 1980s. But the materials that we had said the 1990s, but I want to correct that. And he co-directs the AEI Center on Housing Markets and Finance. Thanks once again for coming by on America Trends.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you.